Welcome to the Ross Chapman Audio Experience.
Hey everybody, we have a recording of a conversation I did a few months back with Misato Ohara from the UX Review, and we talk about all things UX research and UX design. Hope you enjoy the conversation.
So Ross, I think I should start from again asking you who you are and what you do, maybe?
Absolutely. Yeah. My name's Ross Chapman. I'm head of design at Ubodo, which is a product design studio. And I am a facilitator, product designer. I've been running 150 plus design sprints, more focused in remote and hybrid environments. And I'm really aware and kind of leaning into this more kind of remote and hybrid world that I call the Wild West. We're kind of inventing it as we're seeing it, backed by technology. But really the important thing that I'm keen on is bringing people together wherever they are into a shared direction, into a way that they can collaborate, which may be the first time they've ever done that.
Sorry, I didn't quite catch that. Could you please repeat it?
Ignoring Siri. And really just trying to make work work. And, you know, either as a facilitator or a head of design, managing freelancers through design projects. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, just trying to be as valuable as I can.
That's a very interesting. I mean, you've been running physical workshops, like you said, like hundreds of them. Now you're kind of trying to think about what is the best way to learn remote workshops or hybrid workshops. I just wanted to make sure that whoever watching this video knows the definition of what is hybrid workshops. Could you tell
me definitely.
A little bit about what is that?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, I've been running in-person workshops for many years. And I moved to remote workshops before the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And the reason was I was running design sprints, and one of the teams that I was running this with and was about to start with, they weren't based in one location. They were based in Europe. So we quickly put together a way of working, a template, and ran a remote design sprint. Then when the pandemic came along, I had so many people asking me on LinkedIn or Instagram, hey, could you tell us how we're supposed to work now? You know, what are your tips about facilitating teams when they're not in front of you? Mm-hmm. And, you know, throughout my recent years, I've been more interested in how remote and hybrid environments can be, not because I want to stay at home and be a hermit. It's more because the projects that I work on are around digital products, and they're more and more complex. And doing that with a computer makes a whole heap of sense than doing it in a room with pens and paper. So I foresee a future where we're able to bring in data into our workshops so that we can reduce assumption and increase guaranteed outcomes, essentially. But the way to your question, I would describe a hybrid workshop is one where you, and I've done this, you know, in recent weeks and have another one kicking off on Monday, where you have a workshop or a design sprint where some people are working from home, some people are together in an office, and actually location isn't important. They're essentially bringing together themselves, wherever they are, into a shared workshop. Mm-hmm. What that implies is that workshop is able to be as valuable to each of those participants, wherever they are, and ultimately with whatever tools that they have. So typically right now, some people are going back to the office, some people are working from home, and that's what a hybrid setup might look like. But I like the way that Simon Sinek describes it, where you may have a workshop coming up, something happens that day and you're still able to join that, whether you're stuck on the train, you've accessed it via your phone, or you've been able to get to somewhere with other participants. So I think really hybrid means and implies flexibility in how you turn up and how you contribute.
Right. It also sounds like you're implying that not all the participants don't have to be in the same workshop at the same time. Is that what you're implying as well?
Hybrid can be taken to a conversation about synchronous and asynchronous collaboration. Mm-hmm. So asynchronous is when everyone's together, they're talking in the same space at the same time. And asynchronous is in their own time, wherever mm-hmm. that is. And typically that could be anywhere in the world. So I think hybrid lends itself more to a synchronous, asynchronous conversation. And typically the workshops I run, we do together time, which may be 45 minutes together. And then we have more asynchronous communication, which may be through Slack, through Loom video recordings, through a poll or voting. And I think that where we would say work is done within the workshop, work can continue likely at a different pace outside of the workshop as well. So I think to answer your question, hybrid lends itself to more of a synchronous and asynchronous setup, I think.
All right. It's very interesting that you're saying workshop doesn't end at the end of the workshop. It can also extend after the workshop ends. So it kind of makes me think about that. When you think about workshops, everyone get together and then everyone try to contribute to the maximum level. But we can also say that some people, maybe the core member of the workshop participants, but also others can join after the workshop ended as a kind of adding some afterthought or something, like they can contribute in a different way or different levels as well.
I think that is the case. I think the skill with the facilitator or the person running that work stream is the type of activity that lends itself well to that decision-making you really want to make together. The way to get there might be through voting and bringing together ideas and sketching and you know, diverging if you're talking about design thinking. But the together time needs to be when you converge on a situation. I find that's been challenging to do that asynchronously. But what you can do asynchronously is you can do that divergent activity. You can research, you can sketch, you can use a test, you can do multiple activities, but ultimately through that you need to converge on a central point or a central decision. And that's where I think togetherness helps. Now, when that comes into a hybrid situation, I would say, yes, you have to be together in the same time. But, you know, it's the same conversation we used to have. Can you record this session? Because no, you know, this person hasn't been able to come. If that person then watches that video later on and they have a further decision to make, then they have to then schedule another session to go through that, or it disrupts the kind of decision flow of how that project is going. So I think with anything, I'm thinking about building momentum and keeping momentum throughout any decision-making process and how a facilitator can help manage that.
Right. So you mentioned that you're going to facilitate workshops coming up next week. And I know, so you probably have run hybrid workshops or remote workshops that involved looking after people who are joining from remote places. Can you tell us about a little bit about how you run it, and also what you maybe learned, or how did you make sure that the workshops are successful? So yeah, I throw away in a lot of questions there.
No, I like questions, and do keep on asking follow on if things don't make sense. I like to start the workshop in a way that we start on day one with going into what we want to achieve. But that often means before that day one workshop, you need 2 or 3 sessions before then, which I use as a tech check, because I want to make sure that people can log into the space, whether that's Mural or Miro or Butter or Zoom or whatever tool. And I want them to become more comfortable with that way of working, because most of this is brand new to people. Startups are a little more up together, but more enterprise, this is the world that's been flung upon them rather than they kind of opted into it. And those tech checks I disguise as the first session would be an introduction session. We'd get to know each other. The second session would be what's coming up? What does next week look like? These are the kinds of things that you can be a participant of. And then if there was a third session, I'd say, we want you to prepare something for next week. Maybe that's a lightning demo, or, you know, just 7 minutes to talk about your specialism as a form of together research. And to the team, that sounds sensible. It sounds like, yes, we need to do introductions, and yes, we want to know what to expect. But for myself and my team, it's about looking at who is getting engaged, who can, you know, create a sticky note within our virtual space, who's having like challenges that we can broach and help them. And it's all about increasing the opportunity for a successful workshop going into that week. So the workshops start a week before when we do our preparation. And I think to maintain that and ensure that we're getting, I use within Ubuntu Net Promoter Score at the end of a kind of series of workshops and the end of a project, we ask what you know, Net Promoter Score would you give us? Would you recommend us to a friend or colleague? And that I need to think about, how do I reverse engineer that? How do I get, you know, a 5-star review at the end? And so we use activities to engage and make sure that people are having fun, but they're also getting into the problem space. We ask questions more than once. I use the 5 whys, you know, why are we here? Oh, we're here to do this. Yes, but why are we here to do this? And you ask why 5 times to get to the kernel of the problem that we're trying to solve. And I guess finally, it's the workshops, we do the work and the program of activities happens, and that's a repeatable formula. I've done it more than 100 times. Our team have done it, you know, nearly 100 times. And I think that the key thing is just being available to do something together that they enjoy. People will opt in and engage further if they enjoy the activity. And actually, if anyone's starting their first workshop and the invite list gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger, it's because they think that what you're doing is really exciting. They want to get involved. It's then your skill to maybe limit the amount of people in there to about 7 or 8. So those are the kinds of things I would look at to prepare and briefly manage a successful workshop.
Mm-hmm. So how this activity works when you're running hybrid workshops?
I think with hybrids, you're able to have a hybrid workshop without kind of signaling that it is hybrid. So the typical situation I find myself in is either some of the team are individually remote, and then 2 or 3 of the team are in the same room. And I've seen them mute all their microphones apart from one. I've seen some people huddle together around one computer, which is really hard for them to individually collaborate in a space. And the way that I try and kind of ensure that everyone's able to have an equal voice, and that's really the goal of any workshop, is everyone has an equal voice. I personally think that's much easier in a remote environment, because if you've got a computer, a webcam, and a microphone, you're as equal as everyone else. In a more in-person situation, I think titles and roles get a little more amplified somehow. And it's quite hard in person to mute someone or just kind of talk through what they're saying, I guess, yeah. Which is just plainly rude. I think the way to kind of mitigate that is be patient. This is a brand new way of working for most people. Use playful activities. And yeah, in that situation where some people are together, they will suck they'll have a kind of gravitational pull more to that space than kind of spread across the team. So I use a few techniques to help ease that. And, you know, one of the things I do, say we're introducing ourselves, I would say, hi, I'm Ross, I'm head of design, and I'm here to have a great time and lead this project. I'm going to pass to Melissa or Charles or whoever's in the room. And just using that technique, you're able to share how people are going to introduce themselves in an equal way, mm-hmm. so that you don't get this kind of deluge of information from someone that might seem to feel like the gravity is more with them. So yeah, I think it's just about, you know, as Douglas Ferguson would say, controlling the room, being able to share what the process is and the structure and how people need to fill it. You know, that's why I treat workshops as templates. You create a workshop and then you need to fill it with your content, just like writing a tweet in one box. It's that kind of thing. When people know how to contribute, I think you get a much better outcome.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear that you don't necessarily have to signal this workshop is hybrid. It's the same. Whatever format the workshops are, we share the same purpose, which is to make sure everyone has the equal voice. Because what I hear or what I experience personally is it doesn't have to be actually workshops. Even in a meeting, like now, some of us will go to office and then work and then join a meeting in being in the same room, and then some of us are joining the meeting, dialing in from Teams or Zoom or whatever. Then it's hard to make sure that. To make the inclusive environment for those who are dialing in to have the space and time to voice their opinions, because there is a time lag between us in the same room and then those in a virtual space. So how do you make sure that, for me, it's quite hard to kind of, how do you do it?
I'm still learning. It's funny. I had an alignment call with a team earlier today, and I reminded them all to come into the session with a computer next week, because some people look at a Google Meet link or, you know, some kind of togetherness space, and they think that they don't need to be as present as maybe is implied, and they'll just phone in. And right now, technology means that if you phone in, you're actually at a disadvantage, because you can't easily see what's going on, and our workshops are highly visual. So I think, you know, I treat workshops and meetings and actually any work process as, what is the IKEA instruction manual to this? Like, how do I make it really easy for people? And I get the same questions all the time. You know, when are we meeting? What are we talking about? Have you got the agenda for that? And, you know, people laugh when they run workshops and someone asks the agenda, because that's not what a workshop's all about. You mm-hmm. kind of gravitate around the problem, and then you find out areas to go in, as long as you've got some kind of rough semblance of a structure. So I listen, I respond, I point out the elephant in the room. If I find that someone is being really quiet and they're the decision maker, I will ask, hey, you know, Misato, what would you say about this? Does this align with the business objectives here? Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I guess I would like to have more of a calming nature in some of the sessions that I'm in, because it can very easily get very hectic. And I don't want to be in a session like that. I want to give a sense of calm, and we will do the work, but we need to do it in a way that we're all comfortable. Because when we're comfortable, we can start opening up. I don't even care if people turn off their video cam. That is absolutely fine. Part of the reason where I like a more flexible approach to work is, if you're not feeling like being in front of people, you can choose not to be in front of people, but you can still do whatever you need to do, or take a sick day, like do what you need to do. I think the power is more with the employee now, and employers are finding that friction and trying to, you know, build around that with their culture or slightly adjust their mission statement. And I think there's a revolution happening, that the power is with the employee. Or actually, the power is with the people, whether they're contractors, freelancer, employees.
Yeah.
So that is a radical shift. And I think some companies have been overreaching. And you hear of some companies that give you all these benefits to keep you at work. And I think, you know, that needs to flip to, you know, tell us what's important to you. Is it more time, or is it more money, or is it, you know, more flexibility, or, you know, less constraints around the role that you do. So I think the power's with the people. But yeah, to answer your question.
Yeah.
I think just being a kind and listening person is a great start to preparing and running any work session, whether that's hybrid, in person, or remote.
I mean, that's so true. Like, because you can feel that, you can sense someone's being quiet, and you can just call them, like, hey, like, what you think about this? What would you say? And then that really just brings up improved inclusivity. It's such a small thing and simple thing, but oftentimes people are also afraid of doing it, I feel like. When you're actually in the space, I feel like, oh, should I say this, or should I just wait for someone to speak up about this kind of thing? But I guess, yeah, you have to do it if you want it to make Absolutely. The space inclusive.
Yeah, and welcome mistakes and accidents. Like someone earlier asked me to record the session, and I did that, and then Chrome froze and I had to reboot my computer. But I mitigated that by having other people from my team there. But I think you have to accept mistakes. It's it needs to be less of a presentation and more of a collaboration. Like we're working together. It is not I've prepared this work and I'm going to talk for the next hour about it. That is presenting. That is not collaboration. So I welcome accidents. I make mistakes all the time. People think I'm faultless, but honestly, those that work with me know that I make really silly mistakes all the time. But that is how we learn. That is how we get better. And like you say, it's human. It's what everyone else does too. So I think a workshop starts, I get kind of like, oh, is it going to be okay? Is everyone going to show up, or are we going to have to like move it? And yeah, it's good for the heart rate, I think you've just got to love what you do and appreciate. I appreciate the opportunity that the internet and situations like this brings. So I'm just thankful, really.
Yeah, because like you said, you are your clients or your team are thinking of doing remote workshops before the pandemic. So it was like kind of a natural, I guess, direction that the workshops are heading, that people are working from lots of different places, but we still want it to get together to make decisions or do brainstorming or be creative, just simple way.
People usually look for comfort backwards. They usually look at what has happened in the past or what their family has done or what a hero of theirs has done. And they say, I want that. And that's what they've done. And it's usually in the past. It's much less comfortable going to the future and trying something new, and because you could be made a fool of, or, you know, something really bad could happen. You could, you know, get a warning, or there could be a big problem. And I think it's just managing risk and getting over that fear. I mean, this is easy. Like, we're not solving world conflicts in these situations. We're just trying to solve product problems or challenges with some kind of design or technology. And I think just perspective is really, really useful in those situations.
Mm. I also remember you said you envisioned a future workshops, especially when it comes to remote workshops. You said that you can bring in the data into workshops. And I wanted to hear a little bit more about that. How do you do that? What kind of data?
I ran a track at Google Relay, which was Google's last design sprint conference. It was remote because we couldn't travel. And the area that I ran, the track that I coordinated, was about bringing data into design. And I had some fine folks at Google show us a little bit about what that looks like. And I think the technology is coming, the ways of working are coming. They're not quite accessible right now, but essentially I see a future where we reduce guesswork. And any design project usually starts with an assumption. So I think this to be true. We're going to prove that this is true or not. And the data usually comes at the end or close to the end. I think when you can start with data and actually form the problem statement around data, you're starting in a great place. Projects usually start, we feel we need to do this. We need to improve our checkout. We need a better version of our phone because I want to be proud about it when I talk to my friends and family at the weekend and I can show them that it's much better. Mm. They're usually the places that the projects and work streams come about. It's starting, and startups and large tech companies do this much better. Facebook only does this. They only design against data. Mm. And I think that will become mainstream. I think when we're planning our two-year goal, or when we're trying to ascertain what questions we need to answer, it will come from data and the gaps in our data or something like that. And, you know, when we're sketching or prototyping, there have been experiments. Airbnb did like this artificial intelligence prototype. And no one drew anything or created boxes. It was just a machine making this stuff. So I think that's where it's going. I think that's why I know the way that we work and design will continue to evolve with technology. And, you know, I'm not looking to get out the post-its and sticking dots and things on anything anytime soon, because the world and our products are getting ever more complex. Our needs and behaviors are getting ever more complex, and we need a tool to help with that. And that is this computer thing, or this thing in our pocket. That's that's our enabler. And this should do the hard work so we can think and help each other. So yeah, there are things that are coming up. I'm seeing virtual reality workshops where you just put on the glasses and you are in an experience, and that it can either be an experience for workshop participants, or it's enabling you to visualize data in a new way. I've seen prototypes go live instead of just, you know, here's a prototype, now go and develop it. I think the advent of no-code tools means that designers will be able to develop using no-code and launch. Mm-hmm. And nothing will be in a simulation. Jason Fried says anything before launch is a simulation. It's not real.
Mm.
I think the gap between idea or need through data to getting in the market is just going to be reduced all the time. And the way of doing that is going to become more accessible. So yeah, it's a fun future. There's a lot to get involved in. And you know, we think things work fast right now. I think they're going to get ever faster, which is just crazy to me. But there we go.
Yeah. Visualizing data, like that is something to me very interesting. Because when I try to run workshops, not everyone in the workshops have had the direct experience with this data. For example, when I say data, I'm talking about qualitative data that I heard from user interviews. Then what kind of data we can show it to our participants would be something like quotes or insights or higher level insights or more granular data. How can we visualize this data so that in a way that that they can empathize with, or they can kind of spark some draw a line this together with this different, seemingly different insights.
Yeah. That's all coming as well. I think particularly in user research, tools like Dovetail make things super, super easy. Have you used Dovetail at all, or
no,
been aware of it?
Part of it, yeah.
So a tool like that, you're able to, and actually we're doing this in Notion as well. We're centralizing research, and then you can imagine a time where there is some machine learning based on that research. And so you can bring together some intelligence about recommendations. Right now, if we run a user test, our recommendations are, again, based on what we think with our expertise and our knowledge and what we think to be true. But I think when we talk about visualization, we're talking about so that people can understand it at any level. Like my children will be able to understand whether this was good or bad or what we need to do next. And that will come. That, you know, I have no hesitation that all of that is going to come. Our job should become easier, and we should be more accurate in our work.
Mm.
What will likely happen is that we'll continue to get more specialist, because originally computers were meant to do our work for us, but for some reason we've had to kind of evolve with them in a kind of Terminator type way. I spend a lot of time trying to make things really simple to remove ambiguity, and that can come from the questions that you ask users. That can come from the thing that you show users. And you have to take the rest of the team on a journey as well. And I think the skill of running a workshop is trying to make the complex as simple as possible. And that can even be around the structure of the session. Don't run a 8-hour workshop in a remote or hybrid environment. Cut that down into 3 workshops so that you're gradually building up to a point. I think tools will just evolve. People will evolve with that. You know, some of those people are making the tools. Mm-hmm. And I think the areas that have high cost, long lead time and high expertise, that will be lowered. Eventually consultants per se are being challenged right now because some of the advice that they give you can actually Google or you can find out yourself using, you know, accessible tools. So I welcome change, and I think, you know, making things as accessible as possible means that we're able to get to where we need to go much, much faster. But yeah, I am not Mystic Meg. I do not know what the future will bring, but I can see experiments in VR. I can see machine learning. I can see more tools than ever helping us design and create engaging experiences. And ultimately, help people solve their problems.
Yeah, that was super interesting. Thank you so much, Ross. And I've learned so much learning from you as well. So thank you very much. And
that's all right.
Did you have any questions you wanted to kind of cover through during the session? Or
yeah, I'd love to understand from you where do you think user research is going from your point of view? Like, you know, from some of the teams that I talk to, some of them, even startups, they think it's extra. They don't. And I had this question on one of the communities I coordinate. They find it a hard time to explain why user research is going to help later down the line. It's going to reduce cost. It's going to improve success. How do you, I guess, first of all, how do you explain the importance of user research, and where do you think it's going?
That's a very, very difficult question. And I myself, personally, I'm very interested in that. So I think how I'm explaining is that we can look at, call it quantitative data, right? Mm-hmm. Like you said, as a qualitative researcher, I don't trust myself 100% about what I'm saying, what I'm hearing from users. But by combining quantitative data, this story has much more powerful value in it.
Yep.
And what I see when I'm working on a product, the data shows the users are not happy with the product. Mm-hmm. And why is that? No right. one knows in a company.
Yep.
They always think users are happy.
And the quants won't tell you. They'll just see people exiting or you know, unhappiness metric.
Exactly.
And that balance between quant and qual, like that's as much as I understand about research. Like, I am not a user researcher. It's not my specialism. But, you know, I understand that really you need to do quant and qual. You need 1,000, you know, data points on one question, and then you need interviews to cover the qual. To expose the behavior. You can get a bit of behavior from quant, but I think you don't get the motivation behind exactly. the behavior in quant.
Yeah.
And it's funny how at the moment quant and qual are kind of separate, and I just wonder if there's any overlap. Like, can you do 1,000 user tests in, you know, a few hours and get both or get exactly what you need? I think that at scale, and moderated as well. Like, unmoderated, I'm not a huge fan of, because you're kind of like, choose your own adventure. We hope you answer the questions, but And do you know what? Actually, unmoderated means that you can't influence their journey, which is quite nice because you can't talk around, you know, over the gaps or anything. But moderated means that you can ask about that hesitation, or you can. So yeah, I'm fascinated by it. It's not my area of specialism, but I'm just fascinated by it.
Yeah, well, I'm learning about that every day. Like people are asking about us. People will say, "Oh yeah, I mean, I can do research. I'm just going to do it by myself, and then I'm just going to design it based on." But and I'm not 100% against it. As long as you know, we can still talking. I think the thing is that you know, our resource is limited. We can't do all the research for everyone. But at least if we keep talking about what we're doing, what we're thinking, then we can kind of talk. We can learn from each other. We can develop our skills. So same thing between qualitative and quantitative as well. We normally in an enterprise setting, quantitative researchers tend to sit under marketing, and qualitative data researchers sit under user researchers or design or product.
Or data and that big just messy team. Yeah,
one reason we are sitting in a different places, but I think we just need to work together and somehow.
It's funny that siloing of research. I've been in positions where the data team, they would use Tableau. They would kind of look at the quant, and they were asked for direct numbers straight to the executive team for their weekly report all the time. And then the qual, they were like, you know, they did guerrilla user testing. They didn't seek out permission to go out and do, and no one was asking them to go out and interview people and understand their behavior. So yeah, I just find it fascinating. And I was just interested in your point of view, so thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, I mean, it would be great even during the workshops if we can combine somehow quantitative data and qualitative data. As well, that's what I was thinking, because that will really help us make decisions.
Yeah.
Sometimes we can't prioritize things because we don't simply know the business side of the requirement, or just by inviting different people from different departments will make huge differences in terms of the quality of the decisions that we make during the workshop. So yeah, I think by combining different kinds of data, but also making sure that everyone's, again, comfortable talking about what they know as well. So yeah, that sounds, I mean, that's, yeah, what I thought about what I'm listening to you.
Great. Well, thank you so much for this opportunity. I really enjoyed our conversation.